Carlos Castaneda's The Second Ring of Power, Chapter 1, The Transformation of Donna Soledad, Part 1. I had a sudden premonition that Pablito and Nestor were not home. My certainty was so profound that I stopped my car. I was at the place where the asphalt came to an abrupt end, and I wanted to reconsider whether or not to continue that day the long and difficult drive on the steep, coarse gravel road to their hometown in the mountains of central Mexico. I rolled down the window of my car. It was rather windy and cold. I got out to stretch my legs. The tension of driving for hours had stiffened my back and neck. I walked to the edge of the paved road. The ground was wet from an early shower. Rain was still falling heavily on the slopes of the mountains to the south, a short distance from where I was. But right in front of me, toward the east and also toward the north, the sky was clear. At certain points on the winding road, I had been able to see the bluish peaks of the Sierras shining in the sunlight a great distance away. After a moment's deliberation, I decided to turn back and go to the city because I had had a most peculiar feeling that I was going to find Don Juan in the market. After all, I had always done just that, found him in the marketplace since the beginning of my association with him. As a rule, if I did not find him in Sonora, I would drive to central Mexico and go to the market of that particular city, and sooner or later Don Juan would show up. The longest I had ever waited for him was 2 days. I was so habituated to meeting him in that manner that I had the most absolute certainty that I would find him again, as always. I waited in the market all afternoon. I walked up and down the aisles, pretending to be looking for something to buy. Then I waited around the park. At dusk, I knew he was not coming. I had then the clear sensation that he had been there, but he had left. I sat down on a park bench where I used to sit with him and tried to analyze my feelings. Upon arriving in the city, I was elated with the sure knowledge that Don Juan was there in the streets. What I felt was more than the memory of having found him there countless times before. My body knew that he was looking for me. But then, as I sat on the bench, I had another kind of strange certainty. I knew that he was not there anymore. He had left, and I had missed him. After a while, I discarded my speculations. I thought that I was beginning to be affected by the place. I was starting to get irrational. That had always happened to me in the past, after a few days in that area. I went to my hotel room again to rest for a few hours, and then I went out again to roam the streets. I did not have the same expectation of finding Don Juan that I had had in the afternoon. I gave up. I went back to my hotel in order to get a good night's sleep. Before I headed for the mountains in the morning, I drove up and down the main streets in my car. But somehow I knew that I was wasting my time. Don Juan was not there. It took me all morning to drive to the little town where Pablito and Nestor lived. I arrived around noon. Don Juan had taught me never to drive directly into the town so as to not arouse the curiosity of onlookers. Every time I had been there, I had always driven off the road just before reaching the town onto a flat field where youngsters usually played soccer. The dirt was well packed all the way to a walking trail, which was wide enough for my car and which passed by Pablito and Nestor's house in the foothills south of town. As soon as I got to the edge of the field, I found that the walking trail had been turned into a gravel road. I deliberated whether to go to Nestor's house or to Pablito's. The feeling that they were not there still persisted. I opted to go to Pablito's. I reasoned that Nestor lived alone while Pablito lived with his mother and his four sisters. If he was not there, the woman could help me find him. As I got closer to his house, I noticed that the path leading from the road up to the house had been widened. It looked as if the ground was hard, and since there was enough space for my car, I drove almost to the front door. A new porch with a tile roof had been added to the adobe house. There were no dogs barking, but I saw an enormous one sitting calmly behind the fenced area, alertly observing me. A flock of chickens that had been feeding in front of the house scattered around, cackling. I turned the motor off and stretched my arms over my head. My body was stiff. The house seemed to be deserted. The thought crossed my mind that perhaps Pablito and his family had moved away and someone else was living there. Suddenly, the front door opened with a bang, and Pablito's mother stepped out as if someone had pushed her. She stared at me absentmindedly for an instant. As I got out of my car, she seemed to recognize me. A graceful shiver ran through her body, and she ran toward me. I thought she must have been napping and that the noise of the car had woken her. And when she came out to see what was going on, she did not know at first who I was. The incongruous sight of the old woman running toward me made me smile. When she got closer, I had a moment of doubt. Somehow she moved so nimbly that she did not seem like Pablito's mother at all. "My goodness, what a surprise," she exclaimed. "Donna sold that?" I asked incredulously. "Don't you recognize me?" she replied, laughing. I made some stupid comments about her surprising agility. "Why do you always see me as a helpless old woman?" she asked, looking at me with an air of mock challenge. She bluntly accused me of having nicknamed her Mrs. Pyramid. I remembered that I had once said to Nesta that her shape reminded me of a pyramid. She had a very broad and massive behind and a small pointed head. The long dresses that she usually wore added to the effect. "Look at me," she said. "Now I still look like a pyramid?" She was smiling, but her eyes made me feel uncomfortable. I attempted to defend myself by making a joke, but she cut me off and coaxed me to admit that I was responsible for the nickname. I assured her that I had never intended it as such, and that anyway, at that moment, she was so lean and that her shape was the furthest thing from a pyramid. "What's happened to you, Donna Soledad?" I asked. "You've transformed." "You said it," she replied briskly. "I've been transformed." I meant it figuratively. However, upon closer examination, I had to admit that there was no room for a metaphor. She was truly a changed person. I suddenly had a dry, metallic taste in my mouth. I was afraid. She placed her fist on her hips and stood with her legs slightly apart facing me. She was wearing a light green gathered skirt with a whitish blouse. Her skirt was shorter than those she used to wear. I could not see her hair. She had it tied with a thick band and a turban-like piece of cloth. She was barefoot, and she rhythmically tapped her big feet on the ground as she smiled with candor, the candor of a young girl. I had never seen anyone exude such as much strength as she did. I noticed a strange gleam in her eyes, a disturbing gleam and a frightening one. I thought that perhaps I had never really examined her appearance carefully. Among other things, I felt guilty for having glossed over many people during my years with Don Juan. The force of his personality had rendered everyone else pale and unimportant. I told her that I had never imagined that she could have such a stupendous vitality, that my carelessness was to blame for not really knowing her, and that no doubt I would have to meet everyone else all over again. She came closer to me and smiled and put her right hand on the back of my left arm, grabbing it gently. "That's for sure," she whispered in my ear. Her smile froze and her lips became glazed. She was so close to me that I felt her breast rubbing my left shoulder. My discomfort increased as I tried to convince myself that there was no reason for alarm. I repeated to myself over and over that I really had never known Pablito's mother, and that in spite of her odd behavior, she was probably being her normal self. But some frightened part of me knew that those were only bracing thoughts that had no substance at all. Because no matter how much I may have glossed over her person, not only did I remember her very well, but I had known her very well. She represented to me the archetype of a mother. I thought her to be in her late 50s or even older. Her weak muscles moved her bulky weight with extreme difficulty. Her hair had a lot of gray in it. She was, as I remember, a sad, somber woman with kind, handsome features, a dedicated, suffering mother, always in the kitchen, always tired. I also remembered her to be a very gentle and unselfish woman, and a very timid one, timid to the point of being thoroughly subservient to anyone who happened to be around. That was the picture I had of her, reinforced throughout the years of casual contact. That day, something was terribly different. The woman I was confronting did not at all fit the image I had of Pablito's mother. And yet, she was the same person, leaner and stronger, looking 20 years younger than the last time I had seen her. I felt the shiver in my body. She moved a couple of steps in front of me and faced me. "Let me look at you," she said. "The Nahual told us that you are a devil." I remembered that all of them, Pablito, his mother, his sisters, and Nesta, had always seemed unwilling to voice Don Juan's name and called him the Nahual, a usage which I myself adopted when talking with them. She daringly put her hands on my shoulders, something she had never done before. Her body tensed. I really didn't know what to say. There was a long pause that allowed me to take stock of myself. Her appearance and behavior had frightened me to the point that I had forgotten to ask about Pablito and Nesta. "Tell me, where is Pablito?" I asked her with a sudden wave of apprehension. "Oh, he's gone to the mountain," she responded in a noncommittal tone and moved away from me. "And where is Nesta?" She rolled her eyes as if to show indifference. "They are together in the mountains," she said in the same tone. I felt genuinely relieved and told her that I had known without a shadow of a doubt that they were all right. She glanced at me and smiled. A wave of happiness and ebullience came upon me, and I embraced her. She boldly returned the embrace and held me. That act was so outlandish that it took my breath away. Her body was rigid. I sensed an extraordinary strength in her. My heart began to pound. I gently tried to push her away as I asked her if Nesta was still seeing Don Gennaro and Don Juan. During our farewell meeting, Don Juan had expressed doubts that Nesta was ready to finish his apprenticeship. "Gennaro has left forever," she said, letting go of me. She fretted nervously with the edge of her blouse. "How about Don Juan?" "The Nahual is gone too," she said, puckering her lips. Where did they go?" "You mean you don't know?" I told her that both of them had said goodbye to me 2 years before, and that's all I knew was what and all I knew was that they were leaving at that time. I had really not dared to speculate where they had gone. They had never told me their whereabouts in the past, and I had come to accept the fact that if they wanted to disappear from my life, all they had to do was refuse to see me. "They're not around, that's for sure," she said. "And they won't be coming back, that's also for sure." Oh, I got a paper back here, it's just not... Come on. You gotta be kidding me. There we go. Her voice was extremely unemotional, and I began to feel annoyed with her. I wanted to leave. "But you're here," she said, changing her frown into a smile. "You must wait for Pablito and Nesta. They've been dying to see you." She held my arm firmly and pulled me away from my car. Compared to the way she had been in the past, her boldness was astounding. "But first, let me show you my friend," she said, and forcibly led me to the side of the house. There was a fenced area like a small corral. A huge male dog was there. First thing that attracted my attention was his healthy, lustrous, yellowish-brown fur. He did not seem to be a mean dog. He was not chained, and the fence was not high enough to hold him. The dog remained impassive as we got closer to him, not even wagging his tail. Donna Solbad pointed to a good-sized cage in the back. A coyote was curled up inside. "That's my friend," she said. "The dog is not. He belongs to my girls." The dog looked at me and yawned. I liked it. I had a nonsensical feeling of kinship with it. I hesitated. Some part of me was utterly alarmed and wanted to get out of there quickly, and yet another part of me would not have left for the world. You're not afraid of me, are you? She asked in an accusing tone. I most certainly am, I exclaimed. She giggled, and in a most comforting tone, she declared that she was a clumsy, primitive woman who was very awkward with words and that she hardly knew how to treat people. She looked straight into my eyes and said that Don Juan had commissioned her to help me because he worried about me. He told us that you're not serious and go around causing a lot of trouble to innocent people, she said. Up to that point, her assertions had been coherent to me, but I could not conceive of Don Juan saying those things about me. We went inside the house. I wanted to sit down on the bench where Pablito and I usually sat. She stopped me. This is not the place for you and me, she said. Let's go to my room. I'd rather sit here, I said firmly. I know the spot and I feel comfortable on it. She clicked her lips in disapproval. She acted like a disappointed child. She contracted her upper lip until it looked like the flat beak of a duck. There is something terribly wrong here, I said. I think I'm going to leave if you don't tell me what's going on. She became very flustered and argued that her trouble was not knowing how to talk to me. I confronted her with her unmistakable transformation and demanded that she tell me what had happened. I had to know how such a change had come about. If I tell you, will you stay? She asked in a child's voice. I'll have to. In that case, I'll tell you everything, but it has to be done in my room. I had a moment of panic. I made a supreme effort to calm myself. We walked into her room. She lived in the back where Pablito had built a bedroom for her. I had once been in the room while it was being built and also after it was finished, just before she moved in. The room looked as empty as I had seen it before, except that there was a bed in the very center of it and two unobtrusive chests of drawers by the door. The whitewash of the walls had faded into a very soothing yellowish white. The wood of the ceiling had also weathered. Looking at the smooth, clean walls, I had the impression they were scrubbed daily with a sponge. The room looked more like a monastic cell, very frugal and aesthetic. There were no ornaments of any sort. The windows had thick, removable wood panels reinforced with an iron bar. There were no chairs or anything to sit on. Donna Soledad took my writing pad away from me, held it to her bosom, then sat down on her bed, which was made up of two thick mattresses with no box spring. She indicated that I should sit down next to her. You and I are the same, she said. She handed me my notebook. I beg your pardon? You and I are the same, she repeated, without looking at me. I could not figure out what she meant. She stared at me as if waiting for a response. Just what is that supposed to mean, Donna Soledad, I asked. My question seemed to baffle her. Obviously, she expected me to know what she meant. She laughed at first, but then, when I insisted that I did not understand, she got angry. She sat up straight and accused me of being dishonest with her. Her eyes flared with rage. Her mouth contracted in a very ugly gesture of wrath that made her look extremely old. I honestly was at a loss and felt that, no matter what I said, it would be wrong. She also seemed to be in the same predicament. Her mouth moved to say something, but her lips only quivered. At last she muttered that it was not impeccable to act that way. I did not act that way as I did in such a serious moment. She turned her back to me. Look at me, Donna Soledad, I said forcefully. I am not mystifying you in any sense. You must know something I know nothing about. You talk too much, she said angrily. The narwhal told me never to let you talk. You twist everything. She jumped to her feet and stomped on the floor like a spoiled child. I became aware at that moment that the room had a different floor. I remembered it being a third floor made from the dark soil of the area. The new floor was reddish pink. I momentarily put off a confrontation with her and walked around the room. I could not imagine how I could have missed noticing the floor when I first entered. It was magnificent. At first I thought it was red clay that had been laid like cement when it was soft and moist. And then I saw that there were no cracks in it. The clay would have dried, curled up, cracked, and clumps would have formed. I bent down and gently ran my fingers over it. It was hard as bricks. The clay had been fired. I became aware then that the floor was made of very large slabs of clay put together over a bed of soft clay that served as a matrix. The slabs made a most intricate and fascinating design, but a thoroughly unobtrusive one, unless one paid a deliberate attention to it. The skill with which the slabs had been placed in the position indicated to me a very well-conceived plan. I wanted to know how such big slabs had been fired without being warped. I turned around to ask Donna Soledad. I quickly desisted. She would not have known what I was talking about. I paced over the floor again. The clay was a bit rough, almost like sandstone. It had a perfect slide-proof surface. Did Pablito put this floor down? I asked. She did not answer. It's a superb piece of work, I said. You should be very proud of him. I had no doubt that Pablito had done it. No one else could have had the imagination and the capacity to conceive of it. I figured that he must have made it during the time I had been away. But on the second thought, I realized that I had never entered Donna Soledad's room since it had been built 6 or 7 years ago. "Pablito, Pablito, Bashi," exclaimed in an angry, raspy voice. "What makes you think he's the only one that can make things?" We exchanged a long, sustained look, and all of a sudden I knew that it was she who had made the floor and that Don Juan had put her up to it. We stood quietly looking at each other for some time. I felt I would have been thoroughly superfluous to ask if I was correct. "I made it myself," she said finally with a very dry tone. "The narwhal told me how." Her statements made me feel euphoric. I practically lifted her up in an embrace. I twirled her around. All I could think to do was to bombard her with questions. I wanted to know how she had made the slabs, what the designs represented, and where she got the clay. But she did not share my exhilaration. She remained quiet and impassive, looking at me in askance from time to time. I paced on the floor again. The bed had been placed at the very epicenter of some converging lines. The clay slabs had been cut in sharp angles to create converging motifs that seemed to radiate out from under the bed. "I have no words to tell you how impressed I am," I said. "Words? Who needs words?" she said cuttingly. I had a flash of insight. My reason had betrayed me. There was only one possible way of explaining her magnificent metamorphosis. Don Juan must have made her his apprentice. How else could an old woman like Donna Soledad turn into such a weird, powerful being? That should have been obvious to me from the moment I laid eyes on her, but my set of expectations about her had not included that possibility. I deduced that whatever Don Juan had done to her must have taken place during the 2 years I had not seen her, although the 2 years seemed hardly any time at all for such a superb alteration. "I think I know now what happened to you," I said in a casual, cheerful tone. "Something has cleared up in my mind right now." "Oh, is that so?" she said, thoroughly uninterested. "The narwhal is teaching you to be a sorceress. Isn't that true?" She glared at me defiantly. I felt that I had said the worst thing possible. There was an expression of true contempt on her face. She was not going to tell me anything. "What a bastard you are," she explained suddenly, shaking with rage. I thought that her anger was unjustified. I sat down on one end of the bed while she nervously tapped on the floor with her heel. She sat down on the other end without looking at me. "What exactly do you want me to do?" I asked in a firm and intimidating tone. "I told you already," she said in a yell. "You and I are the same." I asked her to explain her meaning and not to assume for one instant that I knew anything. Those statements angered her even more. She stood up abruptly and dropped her skirt to the ground. "This is what I mean," she yelled, caressing her pubic area. My mouth opened involuntarily. I became aware that I was staring at her like an idiot. "You and I are one here," she said. I was dumbfounded. Donna Soledad, the old Indian woman, mother of my friend Pablito, was actually half naked a few feet away from me, showing me her genitals. I stared at her, incapable of formulating any thoughts. The only thing I knew was that her body was not the body of an old woman. She had beautifully muscular thighs, dark and hairless. The bone structure of her hips was broad, and there was no fat on them. She must have noticed my scrutiny and flung herself on the bed. "You know what to do," she said, pointing at her pubis. You and we are one here." She uncovered her robust breast. "Donna Soledad, I implore you," I exclaimed. "Whatever's come over you? You're Pablito's mother." "No, I'm not," she snapped. "I'm no one's mother." She sat up and looked at me with fierce eyes. "I am just like you, a piece of the Nawal," she said. "We are made to mix. We were made to mix." She opened her legs and I jumped away. "Wait a minute, Donna Soledad," I said. "Let's talk for a while." I had a moment of wild fear and a sudden crazy thought occurred to me. Would it be possible, I asked myself, that Don Juan was hiding somewhere around there, laughing his head off? "Don Juan," I bellowed. My yell was so loud and profound that Donna Soledad jumped off her bed, covered herself hurriedly with her skirt as I saw her putting it on as I bellowed again, "Don Juan." I ran through the house bellowing Don Juan's name until my throat was sore. Donna Soledad, in the meantime, had run outside the house and was standing by my car, looking puzzled at me. I walked over to her and asked her if Don Juan had told her to do all that. She nodded affirmatively. I asked if he was around. She said no. "Tell me everything," I said. She told me that she was merely following Don Juan's orders. He had commanded her to change her being into a warrior's in order to help me. She declared that she had been waiting for years to fulfill that promise. "I am very strong now," she said softly, "just for you. But you disliked me in my room, didn't you?" I found myself explaining that I did not dislike her, that what counted were my feelings for Pablito. Then I realized that I did not have the vaguest idea of what I was saying. Donna Soledad seemed to understand my embarrassing position and said that our mishap had to be forgotten. "You must be famished," she said vivaciously. "I'll make you some food." "There's a lot that you haven't explained to me," I said. "I'll be frank with you. I wouldn't stay here for anything in the world. You frighten me." "You are obligated to accept my hospitality, if it is only for a cup of coffee," she unruffled. "Come, let's forget what's happened." She made a gesture of going into the house. At that moment, I heard a deep growl. The dog was standing looking at us, as if it understood what was being said. Donna Soledad fixed a most frightening gaze on me, then she softened it and smiled. "Don't let my eyes bother you," she said. "The truth is that I am old. Lately, I've been getting dizzy. I think I need glasses." She broke into a laugh and clowned, looking through her cupped fingers as if they were glasses. "An old Indian woman with glasses. That'll be a laugh," she said, giggling. I made up my mind then to be rude and get out of there without any explanation. But before I drove away, I wanted to leave some things for Pablito and her sisters. I opened the trunk of the car to get the gifts I had bought for them. I leaned way into reach first for the two packages that were lodged against the wall of the back seat. Behind the spare tire, I got hold of one and was about to grab the other when I felt a soft, furry hand on the nape of my neck. I shrieked involuntarily and hit my head on the open lid. I turned to look. The pressure of the furry hand did not let me turn completely, but I was able to catch a fleeting glimpse of a silvery arm or paw hovering over my neck. I wriggled in panic and pushed myself away from the trunk and fell down on my seat with the package still in my hands. My whole body shook. The muscles of my legs contracted, and I found myself leaping up and running away. "I didn't mean to frighten you," Donna Soledad said apologetically, as I watched her from 10 feet away. She showed me the palms of her hands in a gesture of surrender, as if assuring me that what I had felt was not her hand. "What did you just do to me?" I asked, trying to sound calm and detached. She seemed to be either thoroughly embarrassed or baffled. She muttered something and shook her head as though she could not say it or did not know what I was talking about. "Come on, Donna Soledad," I said, coming close to her. "Don't play tricks on me." She seemed about to weep. I wanted to comfort her, but some part of me resisted. After a moment's pause, I told her that what I had felt and seen. "That's just terrible," she said in a shrieking voice. In a very childlike gesture, she covered her face with her right forearm. I thought she was crying. I came over to her and tried to put my arm around her shoulder. I could not bring myself to do it. "Come on, Donna Soledad," I said. "Let's forget all this and let me give you those packages before I leave." I stepped in front of her to face her. I could see her black shining eyes and part of her face behind her arm. She was not crying, she was smiling. I jumped back, her smile terrified me. Both of us stood motionless for a long time. She kept her face covered, but I could not see her eyes watching, but I could see her eyes watching me. As I stood there almost paralyzed with fear, I felt utterly despondent. I had fallen into a bottomless pit. Donna Soledad was a witch. My body knew it, and yet I could not really believe it. What I wanted to believe was Donna Soledad had gone mad and was being kept in the house instead of an asylum. I did not dare move or take my eyes away from her. We must have stayed in that position for 5 or 6 minutes. She had kept her arm raised and yet motionless. She was standing at the rear of the car, almost leaning against the left fender. The lid of the trunk was still open. I thought of making a mad dash for the right door. The keys were in the ignition. I relaxed a bit in order to gain the momentum to run. She seemed to notice my change of position. Immediately, her arm moved down, revealing her whole face. Her teeth were clenched. Her eyes were fixed on mine. They looked hard and mean. Suddenly, she lurched toward me. She stomped with her right foot like a fencer, reached out with her clawed hands to grab my wrist, as she let out a most chilling shriek. My body jumped back out of her reach. I ran for the car, but with inconceivable agility, she rolled to my feet and made me trip over her. I fell face down, and she grabbed me by the left foot. I contracted my right leg and would have kicked her in the face with the sole of my shoe had she not let go of me and rolled back. I jumped to my feet and tried to open the door of the car. It was locked. I threw myself over the hood to reach the other side, but somehow Donna Soledad got there before I did. I tried to roll back over the hood, but midway I felt a sharp pain in my right calf. She had grabbed me by the leg. I could not kick her with my left foot. She had pinned down both my legs against the hood. She pulled me toward her, and I fell on top of her. We wrestled on the ground. Her strength was magnificent, and her shrieks were terrifying. I could hardly move under the gigantic pressure of her body. It was not a matter of weight, but rather tension, and she had it. Suddenly, I heard a growl, and an enormous dog jumped on her back and shoved her away from me. I stood up. I wanted to get into the car, but the woman and the dog were fighting by the door. The only retreat was to the inside the house. I made it in about 1 or 2 seconds. I tried not to turn to look at them, but rushed inside and closed the door behind me, securing it with the iron bar that was behind it. I ran to the back and did the same with the other door. From inside, I could hear the furious growling of the dog and the woman's inhumane shrieks. Then suddenly, the dog's barking and growling turned into whining and howling as if he were in pain or as if something were frightening him. I felt the jolt in the pit of my stomach. My ears began to buzz. I realized that I was trapped inside the house. I had a fit of sheer terror. I was revolted at my stupidity in running into the house. The woman's attack had confused me so intensely that I had lost all sense of strategy and had behaved as if I were running away from an ordinary opponent who could be shut out by simply closing a door. I heard someone come to the door and lean against it, trying to force it open. Then there was loud knocks and banging on it. "Open the door," Dinosaur Dad said in a hard voice. "That goddamn dog has mauled me." I deliberated whether or not to let her in. What came to my mind was the memory of a confrontation I had had years before with the sorceress who had, according to Don Juan, adopted his shape in order to fool me and deliver a deadly blow. Obviously, Donna Soledad was not as I had known her, but I had reason to doubt that she was a sorceress. This time element played a decisive role in my conviction. Pablito Nestor and I had been involved with Don Juan and Don Gennaro for years, and we were not sorcerers at all. How could Donna Soledad be one? No matter how much she had changed, she could not improvise something that would have taken a lifetime to accomplish. "Why did you attack me?" I asked, speaking loudly, so as to be heard through the thick door. She answered that the Nawal had told her not to let me go. I asked her why. She did not answer. Instead, she banged on the door furiously, and I banged even harder. We went on to hitting the door for a few minutes. She stopped and started begging me to open it. I had a surge of nervous energy. I knew that if I opened the door, I might have a chance to flee. I moved the iron bar from the door. She staggered in. Her blouse was torn. The band that held her hair had fallen off, and her long hair was all over her face. "Look what the son of a bitch dog did to me," she said. "Look, look." I took a deep breath. She seemed to be somewhat dazed. She sat down on a bench and began to take off her tattered blouse. I realized that moment to run out of the house and make a dash for. I seized that moment to run out of the house and make a dash for the car. With a speed that was born out of fear, I got inside, shut the door, automatically turned on the motor, and put the car in reverse. I stepped on the gas and turned my head to look back through the rear window. As I turned, I felt a hot breath on my face. I heard a horrendous growl and saw in a flash the demonical eyes of the dog. He was standing on the back seat. I saw his horrible teeth almost in my eyes. I ducked my head. His teeth grabbed my hair. He must have curled my whole body on the seat, and in doing so, I let my foot off the clutch. The jerk of the car made the beast lose his balance. I opened the door and scrambled out. The head of the dog jutted out through the door. I heard his enormous teeth click as his jaws closed tight, missing my heels by a few inches. The car began to roll back, and I made another dash for the house. I stopped before I had reached the door. Donna Soledad was standing there. She had tied her hair up again. She had thrown a shawl over her shoulders. She stared at me for a moment, and she began to laugh, very softly at first, as if her wounds hurt her, and then loudly. She pointed a finger at me and held her stomach as she was convulsing with laughter. She bent over and stretched, seemingly to catch her breath. She was naked above the waist. I could see her breast shaking with the convulsions of her laughter. I felt that all was not lost. I looked back toward the car. It had come to a stop after rolling 4 or 5 feet. The door had closed again, sealing the dog inside. I could see and hear the enormous beast biting the back of the front seat and pawing the windows. A most peculiar decision faced me at that moment. I did not know who scared me the most, Donna Soledad or the dog. After a moment's thought, I decided that the dog was just a stupid beast. I ran back to the car and climbed up on the roof. The noise enraged the dog. I heard him ripping the upholstery. Lying on the roof, I managed to open the driver's door. My idea was to open both doors, then slide from the roof into the car through one of them after the dog had gone out the other side. I leaned over to open the right door. I had forgotten that it was locked. At that moment, the dog's head came out through the open door. I had an attack of blind panic at the idea that the dog was going to jump up on the car and onto the roof. In less than a second, I had leaped to the ground and found myself standing at the door of the house. Donna Soledad was bracing herself in the doorway. Laughter came out of her in spurts that seemed almost painful. The dog had remained inside the car, still frothing with rage. Apparently, he was too large and could not squeeze his bulky frame over the front seat. I went to the car and gently closed the door again. I began to look for a stick long enough to release the safety lock on the right-hand door. I searched in the area in front of the house. There was not a single piece of wood lying around. Donna Soledad, in the meantime, had gone inside. I assessed my situation. I had no other alternative but to ask her for help. With great trepidation, I crossed the threshold, looking in every direction in case she might have been hiding behind the door, waiting for me. Donna Soledad, I yelled at. What the hell do you want? She yelled back from her room. Would you please go out and get your dog out of my car, I said. Are you kidding me, she replied. That's not my dog. I told you already. He belongs to my girls. Where are your girls, I asked. They are in the mountains, she replied. She came out of her room and faced me. Do you want to see what the goddamn dog did to me? She asked in a dry tone. Look. She unwrapped her shawl and showed me her naked back. I found that no visible tooth marks on her back. There were only a few long, superficial scratches she might have gotten from rubbing against the hard ground. For all that matter, she could have scratched herself when she attacked me. You have nothing there, I said. Come and look in the light, she said, and went over to the door, by the door. She insisted I look carefully for the gashes of the dog's teeth. I felt stupid. I had a heavy sensation around my eyes, especially on my brow. I went outside instead. The dog had not moved and began to bark as soon as I came out the door. I cursed myself. There was no one to blame but me. I had walked into a trap like a fool. I resolved right then and there to walk to town. But my wallet, my papers, everything I had was in my briefcase on the floor of the car, right under the dog's feet. I had an attack of despair. Excuse me. It was useless to walk to town. I did not have enough money in my pockets even to buy a cup of coffee. Besides, I did not know a soul in town. I had no other alternative but to get the dog out of the car. What kind of food does the dog eat? I yelled at her. Why don't you try your leg, Donna Soledad yelled from the back of her room and cackled. I looked for some cooked food in the house. The pots were empty. There was nothing else for me to do but to confront her again. My despair had turned into rage. I stormed into her room, ready for a fight to the death. She was lying on her bed, covered by her shawl. Please forgive me for having done all those things to you, she said bluntly, looking at the ceiling. Her boldness stopped my rage. You must understand my position, she went on. I could not let you go. She laughed softly and in a clear, calm, and very pleasing voice said that she was guilty of being greedy and clumsy, that she had nearly succeeded in scaring me away with her antics, but that the situation had suddenly changed. She paused and sat up in her bed, covering her breasts with her shawl, then added that a strange confidence had descended into her body. She looked up at the ceiling and moved her arms in a weird rhythmical flow, like a windmill. There is no way for you to leave now, she said. She scrutinized me without laughing. My internal rage had subsided, but my despair was more acute than ever. I honestly knew that in matters of sheer strength, I was no match for her or that dog. She said that our appointment had been set up years in advance, that neither of us had enough power to hurry it or break it. Don't knock yourself out trying to leave, she said. That's as useless as my trying to keep you here. Something besides your will release you from here, and something besides my will keep you here. Somehow her confidence had not only mellowed me, but I had given her a great command over words. Her statements were very compelling and crystal clear. Don Juan had always said that I was a trusting soul when it came to words. As she talked, I found myself thinking that she was not really as threatening as I thought. She no longer projected the feeling of having a chip on her shoulder. My reason was almost at ease when another part of me was not, but another part of me was not. All the muscles of my body were like tense wires. And yet, I had to admit that I myself, although she scared me out of my skin, out of my wits, I had found her most appealing. She watched me. "I'll show you how useless it is to try to leave," she said, pointing, jumping out of the bed. "I'm going to help you. What do you need?" She observed me with a gleam in her eye. Her small white teeth gave her smile a devilish touch. Her chubby face was strangely smooth and fairly free of wrinkles. Two deep lines returning from the sides of her nose to the corners of her mouth gave her the appearance of maturity, but not age. And standing up from the bed, she casually let her shawl fall straight down, uncovering her full breast. She did not bother to cover herself. Instead, she swelled up her chest and lifted her breast. "Oh, you've noticed, eh?" she said, and rocked her body from side to side as if pleased with herself. I always keep my hair tied behind my head. The narwhal told me to do so. The pull makes my face younger. I had to be sure that she was going to talk about her breast. Her shift was a surprise to me. "I don't mean that the pull on my hair is going to make me look younger," she went on with a charming smile. "The pull on my hair makes me younger." "How is that possible?" I asked. She answered me with a question. She wanted to know if I had correctly understood when Don Juan had said that anything was possible if one wants it with unbending intent. I was after a more precise explanation. I wanted to know what else she did besides tying her hair in order to look so young. She said that she lay in her bed and had emptied herself of any thoughts and feelings and let the lines of the floor pull her wrinkles away. I pressed her for more details, any feelings, sensations, perceptions that she had experienced while lying on the bed. She insisted that she felt nothing, that she did not know how the lines in the floor worked, and that she only knew how to not let her thoughts interfere. She placed her hands on my chest and shoved me very gently. It seemed to be a gesture to show that she had had enough of my questions. Walked outside through the back door. I told her that I needed a long stick. She went directly to the pile of firewood, and there were no long sticks. I asked her if she could get me a couple of nails in order to join the other two pieces of firewood. We looked unsuccessfully all over the house for nails. As a final resort, I had to dislodge the longest stick I could find in the chicken coop that Pablito had built on the back. The stick, although it was a bit funny, seemed to be suited for my purposes. Donna Soledad had not smiled or joked during our search. She seemed to be utterly absorbed in her task of helping me. Her concentration was so intense that I had the feeling that she was wishing for me to succeed. I walked to my car, armed with a long stick and a shorter one from the pile of firewood. Don Juan stood by the front door. I began to tease the dog with the short stick in my right hand, and at the same time, I tried to release the safety lock with the long one in my other hand. The dog nearly bit my right hand and made me drop the stick. The rage and power of the enormous beast was so immense that I nearly lost the long one too. The dog was about to bite it in two when Donna Soledad came to my aid. Pounding on the back window, she drew the dog's attention, and he let go of it. Encouraged by her distracting maneuver, I drove headfirst and slid across the length of the front seat and managed to release the safety lock. I tried to pull back the safety lock. I tried to pull back immediately, but the dog charged toward me with all his might and actually thrust his massive shoulders and front paws over the front seat. Before I had time to back out, I felt his paw on my shoulder. I cringed. I knew that he was going to maul me. The dog lowered his head to go in for the kill, but instead of biting me, he hit the steering wheel. I scurried out and in one more move climbed over the hood onto the roof. I had goosebumps all over my body. I opened the right door. I asked Donna Soldat to hand me the long stick and with it pushed the lever to release the backrest from its stray position. I conceived that if I teased the dog, he would ram it forward, allowing himself room to get out of the car, but he did not move. He bit furiously on the stick instead. At that moment, Donna Soldat jumped onto the roof and lay next to me. She wanted to help me tease the dog. I told her that she could not stay on the roof because when the dog came out, I was going to get in the car and drive away. I thanked her for her help and said that she should go back in the house. She shrugged her shoulders, jumped down, and went back to the door. I pushed on the release again. With my cap, I teased the dog. I snapped it around his eyes in front of his muscle. The dog's fury was beyond anything I had seen, but he would not leave the seat. Finally, his massive paws jerked the stick out of my grip. I climbed down to retrieve it from underneath the car. Suddenly, I heard Donna Soldat screaming, "Watch out! He's getting out!" I glanced up at the car. The dog was squeezing himself over the seat. He had gotten his hind paws caught in the steering wheel. Except for that, he was almost out. I dashed to the house and got inside just in time to avoid being drowned by that animal. His momentum was so powerful that he rammed against the door. As she secured the door with its iron bar, Donna Soldat said in a crackling voice, "I told you it was useless." She cleared her throat and turned to look at me. "Can you tie the dog up with a rope?" I asked. I was sure she would give me a meaningless answer. But to my amazement, she said that we should try everything, even luring the dog into the house and trapping him there. Her idea appealed to me. I carefully opened the front door. The dog was no longer there. I ventured out a bit, and there was no sight of him. My hope was that the dog had gone back to his corral. I was going to wait another instant before I made a dash for my car, when I heard a deep growl and saw the massive head of the beast inside my car. He had crawled back onto the front seat. Donna Soldat was right. It was useless to try. A wave of sadness enveloped me. Somehow I knew that my end was near. In a fit of sheer desperation, I told Donna Soldat that I was going to get a knife from the kitchen and kill the dog or be killed by him. And I would have done that had it not been that there was not a single metal object in the entire house. "Didn't the narwhal teach you to accept your fate?" Donna Soldat asked as she trailed behind me. That one out there is no ordinary dog. That dog has power. He is a warrior. He will do what he has to do, even kill you. End of part 1 of chapter 1.